Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are streaming on the web at ksfr.org, and this show is podcasting on the internet at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show any time of day thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show at iTunes. Right now, by telephone, I would like to welcome Mirabai Starr. She's an adjunct professor of philosophy and religious studies at the University of New Mexico and is the translator of the new translation of The Book of My Life by Teresa of Avila, the Spanish mystic and saint. It's published by New Seeds Books and also comes in an audiobook version that I've been listening to. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte.
It's great to have you here. Fascinating book. Tell us a little bit about Teresa of Avila. She's a person who, from the earliest childhood, had a strong inclination toward religious life. We're talking about the 16th century.
Right. Yeah, she did. She, like so many of us, was one of those children that it was deeply introspective and had all kinds of experiences, spiritual experiences, at a very young age. And then also, I think, like many of us, those experiences faded as the world began to become more and more alluring. And she lost her mother when she was very young. She was 12 years old, and she had a family of brothers, nine brothers, and she and her father, her single father. And she became quite a handful and got into all kinds of trouble. She was a wild child. And as a result of these unnamed sins that she was engaging in and embarrassing her family, she was sent away to a convent at 16, which was not uncommon in 16th century Spain, especially for a young girl who had no mother. But she didn't have any interest whatsoever in the religious life at that point. Whatever those childhood yearnings were that she had long since faded, and she just wanted to experience life fully. So it was a very painful incarceration. And yet, when she was sent away in the convent, something began to stir in her, and she realized that she was very much drawn to a contemplative life as well. And I would say she battled between that part of her that was wild and rebellious and loved the world, and that part of her that wanted to sit in deep stillness for her whole life until she was 40, when everything changed.
This book was written at what part of her life?
Well, right around then. Teresa of Avila, like so many great beings, great masters in history, didn't really begin to awaken to who she was until she was 40. And there are other examples, St. Francis of Assisi, Mohammed, many other great beings had an awakening right around the age of 40, which is kind of midlife. A little more than midlife in the 16th century. And she actually had a particular moment that changed everything. And from that moment, and I'll tell you about that in a second, she ended up writing her autobiography early on, kind of like now. People are writing memoirs at a young age rather than at the end of their lives. And it wasn't really written as a memoir. Her autobiography, The Book of My Life, as it's known, was written as a response to the Spanish Inquisition that was interrogating her for all of these uncommon spiritual experiences she was having that were being broadcast throughout Spain because they were quite dramatic and flashy. So she was actually 45 when she wrote her autobiography and went on to write prolifically throughout her life. She wrote four other books and hundreds of letters and poetry and other things. But once the Inquisition began to hear about this nun who was having these visions and voices and raptures and ecstasies, they began, as I said, to investigate her because it was very threatening. At that time, the Inquisition, as you know, was a response to the Protestant Reformation, trying very hard to hold on to orthodoxy at a time when the entire structure of the church seemed to be in danger of falling apart. And so in that effort to hold on tightly to orthodoxy, people like Teresa, who was a devout Catholic nun, were nevertheless really scary because she was not only advocating but modeling a direct relationship with the divine, whom she addressed as the beloved. And that did not require obtaining permission from the authorities or going through the normal chain of command in the hierarchy of the Catholic Church.
And so what did they make of her, and what did they do with her?
So they ordered her to document her experiences in writing, because she was literate, which was unusual, and that is where the Book of My Life came from. And they continued to come in droves to kind of test her experiences. What's very interesting about Teresa of Avila to me, as both a philosopher and a Jew, as well as someone on a deep spiritual quest myself, is that Teresa of Avila didn't buy her own experiences without subjecting them to rigorous self-inquiry. So every time she would have a vision, say she would have a vision of Christ's hands, very, very beautiful vision that would fill her. It wasn't just a visual vision. It was a full experience of the presence of her friend, Jesus Christ. And she would have a vision like this, and it would change her completely. It would fill her heart with love. It would brighten everything she saw in the world afterwards. It was a full transformational experience. But she still would subject that experience to the test of her own searing intellect and analysis. Is this real? Is this an artifact of my own mental imbalance? Am I crazy and I'm hallucinating? Is this a trick of the devil, which I translate as the spirit of evil? Or is this genuinely a true mystical experience coming directly from the Beloved? And she was really hard on herself in that way. And so by the time the Inquisition got to her, she had already done a lot of the work that they were going to do and was resting in the certainty that her experiences were real, and that certainty was palpable to them. So that not only did the people who were investigating her believe her, but they became her spiritual disciples. And many of them, I think, fell in love with her because, by the way, she was very beautiful and very charming.
I was going to say, that probably didn't hurt in her relationship with her inquisitors.
That's right. Teresa had great gifts of personality and just radiance of being. I mean, she was beautiful, it sounds like, from everything I've read, on every level, physically, and her personality was just delightful. And she just had a way of getting everybody to just love her. As she says, this was one of her, not only of her gifts, but a curse in her life, because she felt like she accidentally was manipulating people throughout her life to do what she wanted, because she could so easily.
We're talking to Mirabai Starr. The book is called The Book of My Life by Teresa of Avila, and Mirabai Starr has done the new translation of this book. Teresa of Avila is such a curious combination of utterly confident in her spiritual path and in her and her all of her activities, and at the same time, incredibly self-deprecating. She's always confessing. She's always talking about what a miserable and horrible person she is and how she's offended God. What's going on there?
Well, you know, I think it's a couple of things. I think that she was having to accuse herself before she could be accused by the Spanish Inquisition, for one thing. And so she was, those apologies were political. But I think that there's something deeper going on as well. And it's also partly an artifact just of the times and of the belief system, excuse me, of the Roman Catholic Church, where one is trained to strip away any kind of ego, the trappings of ego that might stand between the soul and union with her Beloved. So that's built in culturally and religiously, but on yet a third or even deeper level, I think Teresa of Avila truly wanted more than anything to disappear into the divine Beloved, to just merge and melt into that reality that transcended the small self. And so she truly was making a supreme effort to strip away anything that might separate her from that union of love, that ecstatic union of love. So it wasn't like a sacrifice. I'm a bad person, so I'm going to beat myself up. It was like, please, God, take away anything that stands between you and me.
Well, I mean, I was thinking, I've been listening to the audio book in my car, so every time I turn on the engine, she's saying, and then I couldn't go even one day without offending God. And I think to myself, what kind of offenses is she talking about? I mean, she's not explicit about it. Do you have any idea?
Well, where in the earlier parts, that's a little bit more extreme. When she talks about her early life, really I think that she feels that she was caught up in vanity. She knew she was gifted on many levels, and she used that to get what she wanted in very subtle ways so that everybody looked at her, she said, and thought of her as, oh, so spiritual, because she was praying all the time or reading spiritual books. She was very addicted to reading great books. And she would close her eyes, and she would appear to be in deep states of prayer and transport, which she was, and those were genuine. But she somehow always felt that she was impure because she received so much attention for being spiritual and holy, and she considered herself to be plagued by ego and desires. She was very, very much attached to other human beings in the world. Her relationships were very important to her. In the early part of her life, she saw that as somehow an obstacle to her purity. And later in life, and this is why I ask kind of where you are in the text, it's a lot of fun to read those early parts and to see the naive way that she approached this issue. But later in her life, she embraced who she was completely. She knew that she was a passionate lover, not only of God, but of other human beings. And I don't mean physically, but emotionally. She would engage in relationships with the fullness of her being and become completely attached to everyone that she loved. And she began to realize that that's just who she was, and it was part of her love of God, that she could no longer separate her love for other human beings from her love for God. And she found verification of that approach in the biblical scriptures, that to love one's God with all one's heart and soul and mind is the same as to love one's neighbor as oneself, that these are, in fact, the two great commandments, and that was what she was supposed to do. And the reason she was doing it is because it was the right way to be in the world.
It also really, for those of us on the outside reading it who are not necessarily involved in monastic practices, it really underlines the fact that no matter how much you try to conform to some model like being the perfect nun or whatever, you can never escape from being the personality that you were born with.
What a wonderful insight, Mary Charlotte. I agree completely. And I think that's one of the great gifts that Teresa of Avila has to offer us in the contemporary world. Many of us are not contemplatives or monastics. Many of us are not even religious. And I would, by the way, in spite of how I'm speaking, would include myself in that group. I am very much on a spiritual path and have been since I was 14 years old. Passionately so, but never have I subscribed or been capable of joining a particular religious group. I find organized religion to be often exclusive. And so for those of us who are like me, and I think there are many, Teresa of Avila just speaks to being, as you say, fully, deeply who you are and not allowing yourself to be stuffed into any particular categories or bound to any prescribed prayers or forms, although she says those prescribed prayers and forms are very helpful along the way.
We're talking to Mirabai Starr. Let's talk about the translation. This book has been translated before. Why did you decide to do a new translation?
I've done two others. I did Dark Night of the Soul. I translated that 5 years ago by John of the Cross, who was Teresa of Avila's protege. He was younger than she, and she was really his spiritual teacher. And that book, Dark Night of the Soul, had been probably the most important spiritual book in my life, which is kind of unusual considering my background was mostly in Eastern traditions, and I was born, as I say, Jewish. But I loved that book. From there, I couldn't help but take a look at John of the Cross's spiritual teacher, Teresa of Avila. And the first book I translated of hers, which was my second book, was The Interior Castle, which was the book she wrote at the end of her life and was kind of the culmination of her entire spiritual understanding. This book was going all the way backwards to the beginning. It was the very first book of her life, and for me, it was a total joy to translate this work. It was a big, unwieldy, rambling mess, so a lot of what I was doing was cleaning up the language and just making it clear and accessible, and I hope fun to read. I am a writer. I'm a fiction writer, and I also write spiritual essays, that kind of thing. But creative nonfiction has become a very important form for me, and the beauty of language is very important to me. I love language. And so I approached this translation, and I hope all my translations, not only as spiritual teachings, as masterpieces of spiritual literature, but as beautiful pieces of writing. So I wanted to kind of reweave the language in such a way and craft and carve it so that it would shine and be fun and easy to read, which I think it is. This book in particular is fun because it's all stories. So the other books that I translated, I think are very beautiful, but they're deep and profound and intense spiritual teachings, and you can read a couple of pages and then meditate on them, and, you know, it's hard to kind of just read them straight through. Whereas this one is a great wild romp through the life of this wild mystic who didn't behave at all like people might expect a saint to behave. And so it's just story after story and account after account. And she goes into these great distractions and diversions. What do you call it? She sidetracks herself all the time. It's just fun. Her voice comes through so clear and bright.
And she really, it sounds like conversation. It sounds like she's speaking to you rather than writing.
Yeah.
And I have to say, just in compliment to your translation, the English is so mellifluous, so contemporary, that one is grateful actually to have a translation and not to have to deal with, I mean, even for in our own native language, the 16th century original, which must be much harder for native Spanish speakers to read than a translation.
Yeah, and the existing translations, and there were only a couple, actually three that I could put my hands on, were literal translations. So they were, in fact, quite a challenge to read.
So I would think that, first of all, you have to be somewhat religiously inclined yourself in order to take a project like this on. And second, that in the process of translating it, it would really affect you.
Yeah. Well, I think I addressed the religious aspect earlier in that I have always been on very much a passionate spiritual path. I have a long-term contemplative practice, which is a Buddhist sitting practice. I've read all of the great books of spiritual literature, not all of them, but many of them. But I have never been one who has been able to pick a particular religious path because I find any one way to be exclusive on some level. But yes, that's my spiritual sensibilities definitely drew me to this text, and plus it reminds me so much of some of the beautiful mystics in the Sufi tradition, which I'm familiar with, and in some of the Eastern traditions, particularly in Hinduism and Buddhism. But what was the other part of your question that I did want to... how did it change and how did it affect me? Well, that's very insightful to even ask that question. It does. I mean, how could you possibly hang out day after day with these great teachings and not be taught? And I certainly have been, and it's addictive. I'm actually working on a whole series now. I'm not going to say what because it's secret for now, but I can't stop. I just can't believe how blessed I am to be able to spend every day reading and presenting. It's like I see myself as someone who restores medieval tapestries, and I write about that in my introduction. It's like I'm taking apart the threads and re-dyeing them so that they're bright and clear, and reweaving them so that the original picture is visible again in all its glory, is my hope. And so this is what I get to do. And so I sit down in the morning, I light a candle, I have the original Spanish in my various dictionaries, and I have the existing translations to keep me on track. And I have my pictures of the saints, and off I go. And it's just heaven. I love it.
Heaven indeed. We're talking to Mirabai Starr. So, St. Teresa of Avila, she was canonized. She's a saint. She had a direct relationship with God. The Inquisition came, questioned her, decided that that was okay. Did that have an influence on the subsequent history of the Catholic Church? In other words, was it then okay for people to have a direct mystical relationship with God because of her?
Great question. Well, you know, there had been a long-standing contemplative tradition in the Catholic Church. Contemplative meaning those in the monastic community who chose a life of silence and stillness as a form of prayer, where they would remove themselves and live in solitude. The original desert fathers and mothers of Mount Carmel in the Holy Land were the guides for St. Teresa and St. John of the Cross for the kind of life of simplicity and silence that they wanted to cultivate. So there had been an existing model for that kind of life of sitting with the beloved in silence. But they had long since gotten lost in materialism and all of the forms that Teresa and John were kind of rebelling against. They were revolutionaries in their time. And yes, as a result of their efforts, the church was completely reformed, or at least the Carmelite order, that particular order, which then became a guide and inspiration for many other orders. St. Francis also, a couple of centuries earlier, had done a lot to reawaken people to that direct relationship between the soul and the divine. But the two of them, John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila, really did make a big, big difference in that way. And so there have been, in the subsequent centuries, there has been this tradition of contemplative prayer that has endured and is no longer considered to be a threat, although if you talk to fundamentalist Christians, they certainly would view the mystical path as being dangerous and less than orthodox.
Isn't that interesting? So in a way, the fundamentalist Christian attitude is analogous to that of the Spanish Inquisition.
Yeah, I never quite made that connection until now, but I think you're right. I mean, the way I see it is that fundamentalism is in direct opposition to mysticism. Or rather, mysticism, I see, at the risk of sounding political, I see mysticism as an antidote to fundamentalism. Fundamentalism says this is the way. And unless you do it this way and interpret it in this exact form, you are being a heretic. And that is exactly what the Inquisition was saying. You're right. And mysticism is saying, thank you for the forms. They are beautiful, and I rely on them greatly. And I'm going to go ahead and have a direct relationship with my beloved now because he's calling me and I can't ignore it. And the way that I'm going to do that is I am going to sit still and close my eyes and go within because that's where my beloved is, inside my own soul.
Well, on that note, Mirabai Starr, it's time to go. I want to thank you so much for being with us here on KSFR.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte. Your questions were wonderful.
Mirabai Starr is adjunct professor of philosophy and religious studies at the University of New Mexico, and she's the translator of the new translation of The Book of My Life by Teresa of Avila, the Spanish mystic and saint. It's published by New Seeds Books and also comes in an audio book version, which is great fun to listen to. And that's it. I'd like now to welcome James Basker. He is professor of literary history at Barnard College and author of the new book, Amazing Grace, an anthology of poems about slavery, 1660 to 1810, published by Yale University Press. Welcome, Professor Basker, to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here.
It's a huge anthology of poetry. People who listen to this show know that I read books from cover to cover, but this was even too much for me. It's almost 700 pages of poetry. But one thing I wanted to ask you about was the time frame, 1660 to 1810. Slavery didn't end until the Civil War, which started in 1661. 1861. Why does the anthology end in 1810?
Well, it goes back to the historical framework. We in America are used to thinking of the abolition movement as being really the 1820s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. But this anthology reaches across the whole of the English-speaking world, including the, Great Britain, the American colonies, and Caribbean colonies as well. And the reach is to show how early the subject of slavery had entered the collective consciousness of people and was in their literature, their poetic utterances of various kinds. I chose 1810 as the closing marker because in 1808 the slave trade was abolished both by Great Britain and the United States. Not slavery itself, but the slave trade carrying Africans from Africa to the New World. And so after that, the history changes, and Great Britain proceeded to effect abolition of slavery in 1833, whereas, as you know, in the United States, we had a much patchier history. Some northern states had abolished it in the 18th and early 19th century, but it took the Civil War to end it in the country as a whole.
What were the pressures brought to bear to end the slave trade?
Well, that's a great question. Officially, the politics took off both in Britain and in America about the same time. As you know, there were people in the Constitutional Convention here in 1787 who were adamantly anti-slavery and hoped to effect that in the Constitution, but the southern colonies refused, or the southern states refused to even consider it, and the Constitution represented a kind of silent compromise on that issue. In Britain, there was a political campaign in the 1780s that began in 1787 with the formation of the Abolition Society, and then a petition campaign that generated more than 300 petitions across the country presented to Parliament. And William Wilberforce led the legislative effort proposing abolition bills every year from 1789 until he finally got one through in 1806. And so in both countries, it represented something of a delay and a political fight. The Constitutional Convention postponed the abolition of the slave trade until 1807, 20 years later. Thomas Jefferson actually signed the legislation that made that official. And it was time to parallel the British abolition of the slave trade as well. So they both were effective the 1st of January, 1808.
And so why did it take another half century for slavery to be abolished in the United States?
Well, there were regional differences. It's not quite accurate for us to say that it took another half century. The state of Vermont was the first state in the United States to abolish slavery, and it did so in its constitution in 1777, followed by states like Pennsylvania and other northern states. Massachusetts, New York, Rhode Island, and others had emancipation laws in effect by the early 1800s. But, of course, the South had a tremendous economic and social investment in slavery, and the prospect of increasing the number of slave states to the West as the Louisiana Purchase became part of the United States and then further west really opened up political possibilities that made it a kind of a fault line of political contention all the way down to the Civil War.
It never occurred to me that there are state constitutions that predate the federal constitution, like Vermont.
Yes. Well, remember, we had the Declaration of Independence in 76, and at that point, each of these colonies that endorsed it proceeded to treat itself as an independent state. And Vermont was the first to get its constitution through based on no slavery in the state. Others moved in that direction over the course of the next few decades.
We're talking to James Basker. The book is called Amazing Grace, an anthology of poems about slavery, 1660 to 1810. So this is a very wide range of poems from all over the English-speaking world, as you said. How did you find them, and what are these different poems? They're not all high literature, so to speak.
No. In fact, my anthology is the most undiscriminating one you can imagine. It's a sort of archaeological dig. I turned up and included every poem or piece of a poem I could find that treated the subject of slavery in any way whatsoever, even if it was written by a former slave or a former slave trader or was explicitly about the subject of slavery. And so some of the poems are really graveyard, gravestone inscriptions, newspaper poems. Some of them are satiric poems or pieces of comic operas or plays. Some of them are very serious verse poems that were published as part of the political debates of the time. So they range from high to low. I mean, you have major poets like Wordsworth and Coleridge, and you have utterly unknown people at the lower ranks of literature. But I wanted to show how, or I wanted to see at first how far slavery had entered the collective thinking of the time, and eventually to make that manifest.
And there's many different ways in which slavery has entered the collective consciousness, as shown in this anthology, not only the phenomenon of slavery, but also metaphors of slavery.
Oh, yes. I mean, it's up and down the century. It's astonishing that all this material was hiding in plain sight, so to speak. And it taught me something about research, which is often we can't find something unless we set out to look for it. I'll give you one dramatic example. There's a play written by Thomas Southern in 1695 called Orinoco. It's based on a novella that a woman, Afra Ben, had written in 1688 about an African prince who's captured and taken into slavery and leads a slave rebellion in the New World. It's got a tragic ending. Well, Southern's play was performed frequently in London. In fact, it was performed 300 times between 1700 and 1800. That's an average of three times a year in London. So it's impossible that any theater-going member of the British public had not seen some depiction of slavery, a slave insurrection, and all its horrors on the stage during the course of the 1700s.
And so, if the British public was aware on that level, what was their political stance towards slavery?
Well, you have to consider many factors. One was that slavery was not physically present in Great Britain, and indeed, this was one of the goals of it, was to see how far it was present even in their imaginations. And the second thing is to think about the political system of the time. The amount of enfranchisement of ordinary people was very, very limited. The vote or the franchise was very limited, and in the pre-reform eras was tightly controlled at the top. So really what governed were the economic interests, and the 18th century saw a tremendous boom in the role of Great Britain in the slave trade and in slave-based economies in the New World, in the American colonies and in places like Jamaica. So the economic interests were lined up steadfastly to capitalize on this boom, not just in the ownership of slaves, but, of course, the huge wealth to be made off sugar and rum and all its byproducts that financed not just overseas traders and plantation owners, but, of course, the banking system, the shipping system, and all kinds of merchant trade connected with it.
It's pretty easy to see parallels to the time we're living in today, that although one could argue that we don't have the same institutional slavery, we still have economic interests being made on the backs of people who are incredibly poor, and we also have things like toxic waste and so on that are just overlooked. What do you think about that?
Well, I think there are many parallels that could be made with our own time, but in fact, we can't discount the fact of the continuing existence of slavery today. There's a very active anti-slavery society that operates internationally and has produced evidence that there are more than 20 million people living in unfree conditions across the world today. So it's not an issue that's gone away. What moved me was the degree to which, long before the politicians got involved or a political reform movement started, these creative artists, these poets, had sort of raised awareness and heightened the sensibilities of people who eventually would join the political movement. And in that sense, as I said in the introduction to the book, I agree with Percy Bysshe Shelley, who once said that poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world.
And they're usually considerably ahead of their time.
Well, they can be. I certainly feel that that's true. In three-quarters of the poets who wound up in Amazing Grace, and you're right, there are a lot of them, there are more than 250, and there are more than 400 poems, so it's not a book to be read straight through. I sympathize with anybody who tries.
Right.
And there are a lot of different voices in here. But three-quarters of these poets, somewhat to my surprise, depicted slavery as evil, ugly, something to be eradicated. And this at a time before there was any real political movement against the slave trade.
Now, in this book, there are some voices of either slaves or former slaves. Is that correct?
Yes, there are. In fact, some of the most interesting people are former slaves. The most famous in America is Phyllis Wheatley, who's a fabulous, an unbelievable character who was purchased as a little girl in Boston at about the age of 7, and who immediately was seen to be so bright and so intellectual that her master, who was a merchant there in Boston called Wheatley, and who had purchased Phyllis as a companion to his daughter, he paid for private tutors to teach her Latin and Greek and all sorts of historical subjects. By the age of 13, she was publishing poems in local magazines and newspapers. And in 1773, at about the age of 18, she produced a volume of poems that was published in London, and she went on a literary tour there, was quite a celebrity before she came back to America. She later got involved as a patriot supporting the American independence movement during the Revolutionary War. She wasn't fighting, but she wrote on behalf of it. And she wrote a wonderful poem of tribute to George Washington when he first became commander-in-chief.
We're talking to James Basker. A question that I wanted to ask you was, how important was poetry in the 18th century? Did everybody read poetry? In other words, if you were to have an anti-anything poetry movement in the United States today, it might not even make a ripple.
Well, it might not, unless you thought of it as also being the poetics of lyrics and songs, hip-hop music or rock music, or perhaps a musical in Broadway or a film that had lyrics, poetic lyrics about slavery. So when you think about poetic language as being more present in our culture than just printed poems on a page that we might read in an anthology, poetry is still quite present. But in the 18th century, I think it's fair to say it was much more a dominant genre that people turned to. You think of writers like Alexander Pope, Samuel Johnson, William Wordsworth. They were very much part of the public discussion. I can give you one example of a poem that shows how present poetry was. A man called Thomas Day wrote a poem in 1773 in London called The Dying Negro, and it was a soliloquy put in a black character's voice who was about to commit suicide in despair. A man who'd escaped slavery, a white woman, was about to marry her when he was recaptured and taken on a ship back to the Caribbean. That poem was published as a separate little booklet in 1773, and it sold out four editions. It was a bestseller. Within 12 months, it sold out four editions. And later on, Olaudah Equiano, who was a former slave himself, in writing his own autobiography, he quoted lines from that poem to give voice to his own feelings of what slavery had been like. So you can see that a poem potentially could be very much on everybody's mind as a recent public event.
Were some of the poems, in fact, sung? When you look at when you read through them, some of them really sound that way.
Well, of course, the title poem is Amazing Grace, which is a hymn, one of the most famous hymns. Somebody recently called it our spiritual national anthem. And that poem has an incredible history. Its author is John Newton. And while many people think of it as a poem connected or a hymn connected with the black experience in the African-American community, Harriet Beecher Stowe, for example, had Uncle Tom singing it as he lay dying in Uncle Tom's cabin. John Newton, who actually wrote the hymn back in the 1770s, was an Anglican minister, an evangelical who was an abolitionist. But even earlier in his career, he had been a slave trader himself. And Amazing Grace is written not as a song about black thanksgiving for being delivered from the miseries of this world. It's actually the song or a hymn of thanks by a penitent slave trader for being delivered from the sinfulness of slave trading.
Which is fascinating. I didn't know that. That whole end of it, the sinner repenting, is part of the theme of this whole book.
It is. And there are six other poets in the book who are also former slave traders. And they have tremendous power, partly because their eyewitness testimony, based on the horrific things that they saw and were part of, is so graphic that, it's almost unbearable at times. And yet they can be the most ardent of anti-slavery advocates. The Newton poem is going to have, or the hymn, Amazing Grace, is going to have another resonance this year. There's a film coming out next month, which I recently saw screened here in New York, called Amazing Grace. And it's the story of William Wilberforce, who was indeed influenced by John Newton. And John Newton in the film is played by Albert Finney. It's a fantastic performance. I think everybody will be touched by it.
Now, the vast majority of the poems in the book are anti-slavery. There's a few that are not anti-slavery, that are pro-slavery in one way or another. Mm. What are these about?
Well, the most striking example, from many points of view, is a poem by James Boswell, written in 1791. Boswell is the famous author of the biography of the life of Samuel Johnson, and he's often thought to have invented modern biography, a good case to be made. But Boswell was also, unlike Johnson, Johnson was all his life anti-slavery. Boswell was a defender of slavery. And in 1791, just as he was publishing the life of Johnson, he was also getting involved in the debate over slavery. And it's telling that he thought a poem would be a good, an effective piece to publish to defend slavery and the slave trade. And he wrote this 24-page poem, which is just awful. I mean, it's full of hackneyed rhymes and ad hominem attacks on the abolitionists and some of those racist ideas about how slaves are better off in slavery than they were back in Africa. But it's telling that he chose to publish this as a poem at the time the political debates were going on. And he's one of the surprises that turns up. No collection of the works of Boswell has reprinted that poem since the 1790s. And so again, even though it's an ugly poem defending slavery, it's important that we restore it to view as part of the historical discussion.
I find it fascinating that there's a lot of poems in here that have not been reprinted since they were published centuries ago. Is there some kind of, what would you call it, unconscious motive on the part of scholars to protect certain literary figures from their own ugliness?
Well, I think that could be the case if one is involved with one particular figure like Boswell, but I think the larger fault doesn't lie with any individuals, and it's very unconscious. First, I think that a lot of people have reasons to ignore or suppress depictions of slavery because it's so ugly and so hideous, and even people who suffered from it sometimes turn away with embarrassment or shame or rage. It's just such an unpleasant thing to have in front of us. Sometimes when the political fight is over, whether that's in Britain in the 1808 or 1833 or in America after the Civil War, again, people feel, well, its urgency is dropped. But whatever the motivations, once material like this drops out of the anthologies, the collective laziness of us as scholars and editors, we tend to look at the last anthology and just take things forward from it. Once things drop out, they're very hard to restore to view. And I think that's the momentum that we're trying hard to overcome now, which is to dig up this material that once was very present and very visible and get it back into circulation.
I mean, it's amazing that the Norton Anthology of Poetry, which every high school or college student has on their shelf, doesn't even contain almost anything.
Right. There are only three or four of these poems that turn up there out of more than 400. But to me, this is very important because more largely, not just talking about poetry, and in fact, I'm working on an anthology of fiction as well, and there are hundreds of pieces long before Uncle Tom's Cabin. For 200 years, slavery is depicted in fiction in many, many places. But I think one of the things we need to do is to restore this material to our literary canon, to our historical discussion, because often people think of slavery and the African-American experience as a separate subject. Oh, that's for black studies, or that's for the African-American studies department. Well, of course it's not. The whole history of the slave trade, 450 years of the African diaspora, is a subject that involved whites and blacks, of course. Without Europeans, there would not have been the transatlantic slave trade. So it's part of our collective history, not just in America, but, of course, all around the Atlantic community, north and south. This African diaspora, which is really part of our larger global history and can't be separated from it. So I think we need to do this with the cultural artifacts as a lead-in to reintegrating the subject.
One of the things that you point out in your introduction was that the slave trade was flourishing right in the at the peak of the European Enlightenment. Is this a paradox? Is there a contradiction philosophically?
Well, the history is very complex and not easily reducible to generalizations. For example, we think of the Enlightenment as an increasingly secular time, which in many ways is right. Received religion was under stress or challenge from scientific discoveries, global discoveries, and so forth. But 95% of the abolitionist fervor was led by pious Christians who believed it was a Christian Enlightenment that they were participating in, that human progress would be driven by progress that deepened and extended the influence of true Christian ethics as opposed to false ones or complacency. And ironically, some of the leaders of the Enlightenment, I think of David Hume, who in his writings expressed his belief that blacks were inferior to whites, some of them disappoint us rather profoundly. And we have to remember that out of some of the scientific thinking of their Enlightenment about human beings and human history came these awful pseudoscientific theories of racial difference. So history is much more complicated than the kind of simplistic overviews we get sometimes, and I think it's beneficial to dig into this material firsthand to correct the simplifications.
We've got a few minutes left, and I was wondering whether you'd be willing to read one of the poems in your anthology, maybe a poem by Phyllis Wheatley.
Well, there are a couple of lines of Phyllis Wheatley I'd love to share with you. There's a poem I like very much that she wrote for in honor of George Washington. It's too long to read here, but it's an expression of her admiration for Washington as an American patriot. The most famous of her poems, though, is a very short one, which is also a very controversial poem. It's called On Being Brought from Africa to America. And a lot of people, on the first hearing this poem, think of it as endorsing slavery. It's not, actually. It's a poem, when you listen to the last four lines, it's vehemently anti-slavery and anti-racism. But it's a poem by a pious Christian who's giving thanks for the way that Providence has brought her to salvation. So here's the way the poem goes, and you'll hear it pivot after four lines when she turns to talk about racism. She says, "'Twas mercy brought me from my pagan land, taught by my benighted soul to understand that there's a God, that there's a Savior too. Once I redemption neither sought nor knew. Some view our sable race with scornful eye. Their color is a diabolic dye. Remember, Christians, Negroes black as Cain may be refined and join the angelic train." And there in that last couplet, she's reminding her Christian auditors that, in fact, God shows no racial discrimination, and that blacks and whites in the eyes of God are absolutely equal. And it's as if she's sort of counterbalancing those early lines where she seems to be being thankful that she was brought to America. Well, she's being thankful she was brought to salvation, which is a different matter. And she turns around to attack racism at the close of the poem. A terribly important little lyric that's often misunderstood.
When you publish a book like this, the hope is that it is then used in classes, particularly in universities and so on, to teach students that professors might organize a curriculum around this. What is your hope for this, or what's happening in that direction?
Well, I've been having a great time, not only in colleges, and I'm going to be in Santa Fe. I'm so delighted. There's been a very generous invitation to come and talk Thursday. But I've gone to college on the coke and in high schools and in junior high schools, because really the material here, a lot of history and literature teachers are looking for this kind of material to use with students. It's a little bit more engaging, I think, than some of the standard historical narratives. So my hope is this material get out there. Often it's the life story or the historical context behind a poem. Some of the anonymous black writers in this anthology tell horrible stories about their lives, and we don't know anything about them. We haven't yet dug up the true story of their lives. So I hope there will be more research. I hope that people will take some of these poems and write children's stories or write films. Or I hope that the material will be further disseminated in our culture, because I think there are many, many ways it could be useful.
Professor James Basker, thanks so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
It's been fun. Thank you.
We've been speaking with James Basker, professor of literary history at Barnard College and author of the book Amazing Grace, an anthology of poems about slavery, 1660 to 1810, published by Yale University Press. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. Podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.